Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey there, it's Jen Taub. Today on Booked Up, we have a crossover guest, the incomparable A.M. Holmes. By crossover, I mean she works in all sorts of genres, from fiction to nonfiction to screenplays and even operas. Today, we are talking about her new political satire, The Unfolding, and her best-selling memoir, The Mistress's Daughter, that she wrote in her 30s after her birth mother contacted her. Let's dive in. Hi, A.M.
Hello, everybody.
So,
and from the I'm top. So,
I am so glad to finally meet you. David Handelman has mentioned you over the years, and I realize we have, besides David, another friend in common, or maybe not, maybe you're not friendly with her, but my friend, Jill Greenberg, the photographer,
Sure.
I think you, I never read it, but didn't you do an intro for her horses book?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And then she moved to New York, but I haven't seen her since they came.
Oh, well, they're not a they anymore. So they're divorced. She just literally this month, I should be talking about my friend. It's okay. No, she doesn't mind this because this is like, it's no details where anyone could stalk her. But she's out of New York now. She's renting out her loft and moving to Rhinebeck. So she can
Great.
Yeah, yeah. Which is so shocking to me.
Does she know people in Rhinebeck?
I don't think so.
Because there's some good people up there.
Oh, I mean, well, she was just texting me. Who's up there?
Yeah, my cousin Scott Spencer, who's a writer.
Okay.
And his partner, Joanne Beard. And Joan Juliet Buck, who's a writer and editor and art person. There's tons of people up there now.
That will mean a lot to her. I mean, she's going to be doing her photography
up there.
I mean, she's so incredibly talented. What was the connection with horses, though? Why did you,
I have no idea.
You're not a horse person?
I like a horse, but I'm not like, you know, I don't collect horses. I have no idea how that came to be.
Who collects horses? I mean, I don't know if you, is that the verb?
Sultans collect horses. I've been to horse auctions and seen the
really?
Buying. Yeah.
Was that for work because of the book or why did you go?
No. Up in Saratoga Springs near Yaddo, the artist colony.
Yes.
I've watched horses training. My kid rides, but not you know, at a high level.
Did you like being at Yaddo? I mean, it seems like it's the you know, the mecca. Other than that, in Iowa, Writer's Workshop. What was it like to be there?
There are multiple meccas, but they're definitely both of those are and McDowell, where I haven't been. I was very involved with Yaddo's board for many years, and in fact, co-chaired it and stuff. Yeah, it's great. It's a really good place to get some work done. And it's interesting how productive one can be when outside of your own life and really in a community of other people doing the same thing. And also, like, for me, I hadn't met, you know, conductors and composers and so on before I went there. And so that was not
conductors. Wait a second. It's not just writers then.
No, it's painters and poets and performance artists and a lot of composers. Leonard Bernstein was there a million years ago. Aaron Copland has a big history of composers.
Wait, I'm making notes because this what's I got.
Yeah.
I want to follow up on the Aaron Copland thing in 1 second.
Sure.
But like, I didn't realize that they matched together. It's kind of like my home. Like my husband's an artist and has a studio in the backyard. It really does help to be around others that work, you know, sort of project by project and understand the value that procrastination is the only way you actually get stuff done.
That's hard for many people to understand.
Yes, my producer probably doesn't realize that my secret plan in launching this podcast Booked Up is that I'm actually on a writing deadline. for June 15th, I've got to get my manuscript of my next book in. So, you know,
right.
That.
Yeah, but then you add more other things that you have to do because that's when you get it done. Yeah.
It's amazing. I've been incredibly productive over the past few months because the anxiety around, does this suck? Can I really do this?
Right.
And the agonizing, I'm getting back into the write fast, edit slow, which mm-hmm. is a mm-hmm. better mode for me. But this is mm-hmm. about you, not about me.
I want to hear the, what, how long were you? What is the new book about?
Shit, you're not allowed to do this. Okay,
yeah,
the new book. Well, do you even know the old books? I mean, have you really prepared for this conversation?
No, I have not fully prepared,
You've got to understand this in the context of the body of work. So my first book was called Other People's Houses, about the 2008 financial crisis. Kind mm-hmm. of, it was a narrative linking the savings and loan debacle to the 2008 crisis. It was published by Yale Press. It's actually... Mm-hmm. a really good book, but I don't think it got as much attention because it requires people to actually read a narrative. And it starts with, I decided to kind of, this couple called the Noblemans. Well, let me back up. There was a famous Supreme Court decision from 1993, which is the one that interfered with the ability of people who are underwater on their home mortgages. Like if they owed more on their mortgage mm-hmm. than the home was worth, they couldn't cram it down. This is something you do that's a pejorative expression, but in any other kind of loan, you can use bankruptcy restructuring to reduce
right.
the amount of principal you sure. owe to the value of the asset. Well, mm-hmm. you can't do that with home mortgages because of this 1993 case called Noblemans versus United States. So I decided when I met with my editor, you know, when I was talking about writing this book, he said it should be a narrative. And I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. And I started to think about, we had this meeting over lunch, and I thought, because it was a new editor, the other guy had left the press, and I was freaked out, and this new guy really wanted a narrative, and I had to scrap my plan. And I was driving home from New Haven up to Northampton, thinking about, you know, who's my people? You know, how am I going to talk about
sure.
the 2008 crisis? And I thought, what would ever happen to the nobleman? So I literally got mm-hmm. home, you're not going to believe this. I get home in my house. I pop open my laptop. I'm like, Google, you know, what happened to them? I'm like, oh, well, Leonard died right after the case. But what happened to Harriet, his wife? Do you know what happened to Harriet?
She lives like around the corner.
No, even more interesting. She had she had just died, and her funeral was right when I was having lunch with the editor.
Really?
Really. So I was like, holy shit. So
right.
then I went from there, you know, instead of actually writing about the 2008 crisis, because mm-hmm. of course, procrastination, I pulled that thread I got from the National Archives, like their bankruptcy. I actually met her daughter in Texas at the mm-hmm. condo that was the subject of the case. Anyway,
wow.
you don't need to know about this thing, but
no,
I
but
recommend
that's so
the book.
Interesting. Yeah, I will
But
read
then...
Yeah.
The other, but what was interesting is after I dug into this family and what had happened, it turns out they had lost their condo because it was underwater because of the SNL mm-hmm. sort of boom and bust okay. down in Texas. I'm like, well, what about the other party? It wasn't versus United States. I'm sorry. It was a Noblemans versus American Savings Bank. That was mm-hmm. the other party. I'm like, well, who the hell is American Savings Bank? And then I come to find out they were the largest savings and loan to fail during the crisis.
Right.
And then I traced them forward.
Yeah.
And they became, I went backwards to how they blew up. And then mm-hmm. I went forward and they got swallowed up by Washington Mutual, who became the largest thrift to fail during the 2008
sure.
crisis.
Right.
And then,
right.
but it was, but then anyway, there's this whole, you just have to, there, it gets, this bank becomes a character in the book. Anyway, I enjoyed writing that.
I would totally read it because I find that fascinating. I really do.
Oh, that's I will send you a copy. But that was the first, that was the first book. And the second book was on white collar crime called Big Dirty Money.
Mm-hmm.
And it, although it doesn't take a narrative approach, it does dig into the history of the term white collar crime about Edwin Sutherland. Anyway, I love that book, and that, but that one wasn't with Yale Press; it was with Viking. So what I'm doing now is a second book with Viking. I have an incredible editor there. I had great editors both
who's
places.
Who's your editor?
Wendy Wolf.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
She's a legend. I had Bill Frucht at Yale Press, also legendary, also really good. Right. People tell these stories like, oh, you know, my editor didn't do anything. I'm like, what are you, what? You know, you want your editor to be in your face and questioning things, not micromanage. And then, so this new book is on tax. I will stop talking about myself, damn it. But it's called, the working title is Taxation Nation, Lessons from the Loophole Factory. And I'm writing about the history of tax and where we are now. Who knows if the title will stay the same, but I decided to do this one. I'm taking it a step further. I'm kind of going back to the narrative way, but also decided I'm doing my own investigative journalism. So I decided to go visit some tax havens. So I went to Cayman. I don't know if you've been there. Nope. And I went to the Channel Islands, to this place called the Bailiwick of Jersey. Anyway, it goes on and on. So I'm supposed to be writing that book. And I also, of course, went to Washington, D.C., and I've met with people there. And I have binders of things to read, articles to read. And I have, you know, I have books to read, and I have writing to do and transcripts to update. But instead of just launching right into that, I decided to do a podcast instead. So that's where we are, AM.
One last question on this. Are the tax havens interesting places to visit?
Unbelievably interesting.
Do they have the feeling of being a tax haven?
Yes, in different ways. Because Jersey also has the feeling of being a place which you may not know was occupied by the Nazis during World War II. Oh, there's so much. And I actually, because of, you know, this habit of meeting people, I mean, you may collect horses. No, you don't. But I collect people. And so between the people I collect, you know, and also I do this thing where I announce to everybody what I'm doing. So then they tell me things. So I'll tell people, I'm going to Jersey. And then people are like, New Jersey. But then someone says, oh, I have a friend in Jersey. And then I get to be having cocktails in this, you know, by the water and meeting really interesting people who will be in the book. I can't tell you any of the meetings. But that's how I kind of go about my process in a somewhat linear way and then a somewhat sort of superstitious and it's all about people way. Anyway, but can we just...
Yes.
I feel like you could really be my friend in real life.
I can.
I think this is the beginning of a friendship. Are you in New York City? When can we hang out?
Whenever. I'm here.
Okay, good. So tell me, what was I supposed to be doing here? Oh, tell me about... forget the... Oh, the Aaron Copland thing. You wrote an essay for the Paris Review about how you used to write letters to famous people. And I realized, since you just name-dropped Aaron Copland, the composer, when I was in elementary school, my teacher had us make a book for Aaron Copland's whatever birthday it was. Like, it's in the 70s. Right. And I remember that we, like, made it and then, like, sewed it together, and they and she apparently, you know, presented it to him at something. That was my first letter to a famous person. Okay, enough about me, AM. Yeah. You. What about you? What are you working on now? Oh, never mind. I'm not asking you that. You threw me off. Okay, I'm going back to talking about your work.
Sure.
So why I'm having you here, even though this is mostly about nonfiction writers, is that you are engaged in fiction, nonfiction, and even your fiction depends upon reality. And, you know, we were kind of communicating beforehand by email, and I think I've come to bit to understand what it is that you're trying to do. And I mean, how would you explain why you situate your characters inside of these really important historical moments?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's been part of a progression for me. So it's on the one hand, looking, you know, at the whole of my career so far, my subject matter is American society and culture, World War II to the present.
That sounds like a class I would take.
I know. But, you know, I think I am always writing about American society and culture, and in some ways a little bit with an almost anthropological lens. And so I'm always reading the culture and writing in, you know, not, I don't want to say reaction because it's not reaction. It's in some ways, you know, how do we make sense of things? And I would say that the reason that I'm using fiction most often is because I feel like by using fiction, I can also access the psychological and the emotional aspects of American social, political, cultural, economic life in a way that are it would be difficult to do in nonfiction. So that's the short, long answer to that.
But that's how we live our lives. Like I was thinking a lot about your most recent book, The Unfolding, and I don't want to tell people too much beyond maybe what is sort of at the beginning, but it takes place in this sort of fictional slash real world on the evening of the 2008 election, when mm-hmm. Just before and just after Barack Obama is elected and takes us through that inauguration. So that the time frame of the book is then, but you wrote it over many years. And it's sort of at the heart of this book, or at least the heart of this book is both a family story, the relationship between this a father, a daughter, his wife, what's going on with that as they live and breathe their very differing reactions to what this election means. And then the father kind of becoming part of this group that wants to interfere with the peaceful transfer of power. So this is kind of how this story is told. And it just seems to me that you're using this family to kind of do both, talk about the personal and talk about the political at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are sort of, you know, a variety of threads in the unfolding, and that's quite purposeful. I wanted to sort of tell the large scale, what we would describe as the great American novel, which is traditionally a very male form. Women mm-hmm. don't write the great American novel.
Right.
And that piece of the story is definitely about the main character, the father, who's known as the big guy, and ultimately the cohort of like-minded men he brings in to reclaim their vision of America, because they're upset that Obama has won. And that ties to a something that I feel like is true to our history, which is that what seemed like a moment of great hope and progress to many of us also seemed to trip off a barely latent but powerful thread of racism and mm-hmm. sexism in this country that's still blossoming fully today. And so part of it is I'm literally looking at 2008 as a lens of how we got to where we are now. And then definitely in the family, I also wanted to look at sort of a multi-generational story of women's lives mm-hmm. and kind of different kinds of awakenings. A daughter, Megan, voting for the first time in 2008, who begins to realize perhaps she doesn't see the world in the same way as her parents or as she was raised. And the mother, Charlotte, kind of realizing that she has not yet lived her own life, that she was focused on being a wife and mother, and her identity has been sort of, you know, overtaken by that. So how does she mm-hmm. get to claim some space for herself, which is, I would say, the sort of the more intimate and domestic story within. And then the big guy, who is this space-occupying person who doesn't realize what it means to be a space-occupying person and how crippling that is to those around him, and his own kind of coming to consciousness as he realizes that he might be a little bit of a jerk and he might not be quite the good guy that he thinks himself to be.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I do like that the characters seem so real, but they are emblematic. I mean, by mm-hmm. having a character called the big guy, you stand in for patriarchy or stand in for anyone, as you're saying,
yes.
that can take up all that space. I've been thinking so much about some of the metaphors in the book, because as we talk about this idea of the domestic and then the also sort of larger narrative, I think about two things. One, on the plane when Megan is sitting next to a journalist and she's eavesdropping on a conversation, and he asks her, "Did you get that down?" And she explains to him that she is journaling. She keeps a journal, whereas he says, you know, he's a journalist. And then I thought about the other that sort of mirrored with when her mother, Charlotte, quotes Joan Didion mm-hmm. and talks about, you know, the kinds of people who keep journals. And as I was thinking about this, it just dawned on me that you are, that what you're doing, the project is journalism and journaling. And I don't know if you realize that those sat next to each other that way.
No, I had no idea, but you're totally correct. Yeah. And that in the best of ways, that's the beauty of writing, right? Because there are things that one does and things that, you know, a reader realizes and makes note of that make perfect sense, that are not overtly conscious, but that 100% are accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I find that, when you're doing, yes, if you step back as a reader of your own work, if you can get enough distance. Yeah. The other thing I noticed, and this I'm sure was not intentional, but the food that the daughter, Megan, liked to eat was a tomato sandwich sprinkled with sea salt. And I thought, is that a reference to Harriet the Spy with her notebooks?
Oh, interesting. I don't know. Does Harriet the Spy eat tomato sandwiches?
Did you read Harriet the Spy and then the sequel, The Long Secret, or no? You never read those books?
I remember Harriet the Spy the littlest bit, but not well.
Oh,
wasn't a big book for me. I know it was for many people.
Yes, I was a constant journal keeper and, you know, eavesdropper and note taker, and that's why I was thinking. The thing about the great American novel, which you said is usually that title is given to big books by men, and we can think of different ones over the years. And I wonder if I know you use a name that doesn't have a gender associated with it, but you haven't decided to be someone like George Eliot to completely have, well, in that case, George Eliot has had a male name. She chose that. But, you know, do you think that in the world we live today, that anyone who is identified as not being male, critics will ever say something they produced is the great American novel? Has any book by a woman ever been given that?
Right. I think that's a good question, and that's a good way of phrasing it. I don't know if it's ever happened. I think that both the publishing and reviewing and, you know, sale and consumption of fiction in this country is very gendered in a way that it's not outside of this country, including that, you know, often it has been said that men don't read books by women. And I don't know that that happens in Europe or in other places. And then a male writer asked me, and it was a very good question, why women didn't write the great American novel. And I said, well, you know, historically, women were not necessarily in the workforce, you know, even at the turn of, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century. If they were, they were at low-level jobs and had to leave when they got married, or, God forbid, if they got pregnant. And so they didn't have access to the great American experience. They also didn't have access to the economy, you know, not until like the late 1970s could a divorced woman get credit, could buy a car, could have a credit card. You know, a woman's credit was tied to her husband.
Right.
So financially, too, women were not part of the great American experience. And I think that piece of it is something that on a sort of academic and economic and cultural level, I don't feel like anyone's particularly written about or talked about. But it explains to me why women were left in the kitchen writing, you know?
Huh. But since we're, if we had to, since we're just using this label, who would you, what novels, I mean, I have a few in mind, but I'm curious which ones you would think over the years have been considered, or novelists have been considered in that category. And would you say Dreiser, or?
I mean, Theodore Dreiser is a man, right? So
I know, no, not women. I'm saying men, just because I'm curious, what are those books that we would say?
Yeah, so absolutely, yes. Trying to think in terms of, I mean, there are many, but they're not by women, you know? I think all of the Jonathans in the recent years are considered, you know, among the great American novelists. You know, there's not that many Davids, but there are a few. It is interesting, but I think, you know, it is it's a misnomer, because I also think, you know, outside of the U.S., they don't say, what is the great British novel? You know, Hilary Mantel was certainly considered a great contemporary British novelist, and her books were both historical and of enormous kind of scope and scale and so on. know.
Yeah, maybe it's just a weird way of trying to be in the in sort of an America, you know, there's this expression in academia about publishing within the right academic journals, and the, you know, when you're on the job market and people say, you know, they can count but they can't read or something, and there's that mm-hmm. way that maybe it's all about like what is the best, what wins the award, right. as opposed to what do you enjoy, what speaks right. to you, what are the books. I mean, I mm-hmm. always find it weird if someone says, "What's your favorite book?" I haven't had a favorite book since I was in eighth grade.
Right,
it was
exactly. yeah.
To Kill a Mockingbird. Then it became right. the sort of litmus test for whether I could be someone's friend. I remember literally right. asking that before I would continue the conversation.
Right.
Now, if someone asked me,
but it was a better question to ask than which Barbie do you like? Right? There's that other. I mean, there were other friends who would be like,
yeah.
You know, so
I wanted Barbies, but my mother wouldn't let me have them.
Me too, and my mother wouldn't let me have them. That's so interesting.
I finally got my friends to give them to me for my birthday.
I got one when I finally.
Which one did you get?
I don't know which one it was, but I was like, "Look, Mom, I got to go over to Susie's house, and if I go without a Barbie, I'm in big trouble, and it's not going to work."
It haunted me my whole life because I used to work when I was a corporate lawyer in the GM building. I think they may mm-hmm. call it something else now. That's where my law firm was. And that's where FAO Schwartz used to be. And in the 90s, I don't know if you remember, but if you go in the back door of that building off of, I guess, what's the one after Fifth? Like, is that Park
Madison?
The next street? Madison. So if you go on the Madison,
yeah.
Madison Avenue entrance, yeah. and then there's a glass window, and there was this giant sort of funnel, just a cylinder filled with water and tiny little Barbie shoes that would go from the ground and bubble to the top. And every morning I would have to stare at that as I walked in.
Yeah. Well, I famously wrote a story about a boy dating a Barbie doll. You know, I wrote a very famous story called A Real Doll about a boy who's dating his sister's Barbie. And it was interesting because a lot of magazines wanted to publish it, including like Playboy and so on. And their lawyers advised them not to, citing the case of Debbie Does Dallas versus the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders, because Mattel uh-huh. was famously litigious about Barbie. And there was an open question to as whether Barbie was a public figure and could be written about. And, you know, Todd Haynes made a movie that had Barbie in it and so on and went to court. And then ultimately, as Barbie grew up and kind of came of age, all the writers and artists who'd grown up playing with or not being allowed to play with Barbie made work about it. And ultimately, I would say that the threat of the case went away. And Barbie, I would say, has become a public figure, which is interesting.
You know, I think when I was a child, I didn't understand what any objection could be. And now there's so much. There's so much.
Yes.
So where did you grow up as a kid? Like, where did you run around? Or were you in a city or?
I grew up in Chevy Chase, Maryland. In the very strange edge of Washington, D.C., surrounded by my family were basically socialists, so it was not the right place for socialists to grow up. And, you know, we couldn't have grapes because they weren't union, and we couldn't have lettuce because it wasn't union. And all around us were kids who had, like, diplomatic immunity and so on, and our bikes would get stolen. And the police couldn't get them back because they weren't able to go into their driveways. And it was just a wacky, wacky place to grow up.
That is so absurd. And did you always, was there a point in your life when you started, you remember starting to write? And what was that about?
Well,
like, how did you, what kind of yeah. writing were you doing? Or wasn't it always, and let me just back up and say, I think that you've written essays. I think the essay that I was referencing about writing to famous people, you reference having a great deal of anxiety. I mean, obviously, if you listen to me, I clearly have a lot of anxiety. I wouldn't have the energy to do the stuff I do, right? That's where it goes. But I wonder if that was related to your writing when you were young and how that happened.
Oh, anxiety? No, I don't think so. I mean, I think more importantly, I'll show you. Here is
okay.
my first book.
What is that?
It is my first
it's
book.
Beautiful.
The
your first book.
Stories of Haunted Holmes Hollow.
What yeah. age? And it looks like you have bubble letters for the half title there.
It was in the early, it was like 1972.
Oh my God.
It's dedicated to my right hand. No, so I actually really had learning issues. So I was quite dyslexic and quite impaired. And so school was not easy for me, nor was writing. And so it's interesting because nobody thought that I would be a writer, but they meant like Like, you won't write a check. You won't write, like, your homework. You won't do anything, much less be a writer. There was no understanding at that point that creativity or intellectual power were, you know, separated from the ability to form accurate letters with a pen. And so it was a pretty, I would say, a pretty nightmarish time. Mm. And so I think my anxiety, I mean, like, there's so many things one could talk about, but school stuff was hard. And so writing for me didn't become a thing that I thought I could do on any level until some point in high school. And then actually I wrote a bunch of like papers. I liked history a lot, funny enough.
That doesn't surprise me, right?
Exactly, about the history of the CIA and all kinds of other, you know,
Wait. In high school, you wrote about the history of the CIA, right? When you were, is it because of where you were located that made you interested or what?
Yeah. And because lots of people around me, you're like, what does your dad do? And they're like, I don't know. there was a lot happening. And Washington in the 60s and 70s was pretty wild.
You were there in the Nixon. You were writing that book in the Nixon era.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that, I would say Nixon's, you know, Watergate and all of that was the dovetail, I think, for me of my kind of coming of age morally and intellectually and watching, you know, those hearings were the first hearings that were broadcast. And it was riveting and disturbing. And it was also in that period that it didn't occur to me that Washington kind of ran the whole country. I was at summer camp as a Jewish kid raised in that Washington area. Somehow my parents sent me to a Christian camp in North Carolina in the deep South. And that's where I was when Nixon resigned. And I remember people were crying and I was thinking, there's got to be a party happening. Yeah. And so that was a moment where I was like, wow. So wait, Washington affects the whole thing. And, you know, when you grow up there, you don't realize that. And then it's a little worrisome because you see how Washington works and doesn't work. And you're like, wait, this rinky-dink southern town, you know, runs this country? and, you know, all these people's dads with their weird jobs and their weird habits are, like, deciding what's going to happen next? So I think that was, on one level, very inspiring because anything could happen. You know?
And just going back to the writing, so you write this paper about the CIA, and it was through, so it was in history, like research papers in history class that made you decide you enjoyed writing. Is it the writing that you enjoy or the discovery or the, like which part?
I don't know. I think I like information. I like learning about things. Mm. I'm very curious. I like the ways in which, all the more even recently, that we are discovering more. That history is really histories. There are many histories within a history. And it's all storytelling. So it's all, to me, like incredibly rich, fascinating stuff. And then a little later, I got interested in art history. And that was fascinating, too, to realize the ways in which actually art, literature, music tell the history of a time period. And in some ways are different, if not better, witnesses than documentation of the time period, right? Than, you know, hard fact.
Yeah, I'm just thinking a lot about the work you produce and your process and how different so when you're doing historically real fiction, obviously you're getting to research things, getting facts accurate, doing that. But that's very, and of course, communicating those pieces, but that's a very different process than really looking and watching people and hearing the way they speak and the kinds of details and behavioral details that come up when you're writing fiction that allows for, you know, us to hear interior monologues. And I wonder, do you have like some sort of separation between the two sides of your brain? And then, or do you do one piece at one time, one the other? Like, this is not usual. I mean, you may say you have dyslexia and that's neurodivergent, but what you do here is not the usual. So how does that work?
I will say one of the ways that it works is it takes a long time. So that's a piece of it. And yes, there's absolutely a ton of research and a ton of studying. And then ultimately I'm creating characters. So the characters, the question is always, once I sort of begin to create a character, is what is organic or true for this person? And in order to know that, I need to know, how did they come to this moment? Why are they in this moment? What preceded them here? How do they see the world? I think a lot, weirdly, about people's economic lives, because I think a person's economic status changes how they live, changes their experience of the world. Obviously, a family, you know, like this family, if they were all living in a one-bedroom apartment, would be a very different experience than having multiple homes across the country and, you know, not at all having to think about their financial lives in terms of what they can afford. That's huge. And that's one of those things when one either writes or studies fiction, no one ever talks about. No one talks about the economic life of the characters. But I need to know that.
That always annoys me. I don't know a single person who doesn't, once they're over the age of 10, doesn't think constantly about economic lives. Yeah.
And including kids actually think about it a lot.
Yes.
Mom, can I have this? Can I have that? Yeah, totally.
It's always yes or no based on can we afford it, no matter how much money you have.
Right. And so that interests me a lot. But also, you know, given what I then sort of pull together in terms of this portrait of a person, it has to be both organic to them and accurate for them, which are sort of the same. And so it has to be like, well, how does this person see the world? How do they think about the world? What are their relationships like? How do other people see them? And in those ways, I would say my, if not training, my awareness comes a lot from playwriting. And that's very, I think, on display in this book, because there's a lot of dialogue and not a lot of sort of direction between things. And from reading playwrights like Harold Pinter, Carol Churchill, the English playwright, Edward Albee. And what all of those playwrights do is they talk about things without having to name the thing they're talking about.
Yes, yes.
And to me, that's also what we are all doing when we're having conversations about our lives. And that is very different than, in some ways, than reporting or than journalism in the most classic sense, because it is being a witness to the ways, in some ways, that they're avoiding the conversations.
So true. And in journalism, I mean, and I'm being general here, reporting, if we just call it reporting, we know the order of information. You you start with the like most important thing, even if you have a hook, and then you sort of get, And to me, you show your playwriting skills as well as your incredible storytelling skills by the decisions you make about pieces of information that you reveal. And I would just say, I guess it's so toward the beginning that it doesn't really reveal much, but we have the big guy at the very beginning at a bar having drinks with somebody who we come to find out has been in a pool,
right,
swimming. And then much later, we find out who he's gone swimming with, which is somewhat relevant. But it's this moment where it allows the reader to go, oh, then why didn't he say? And there are lots of, there's just, and I appreciate that. Whereas with a, you know, not that all journalism or all nonfiction is just strictly let's follow things in chronological order. A good writer won't do that. But there's so much of that showing and not telling that you do by what people don't tell each other, what they don't say. It's really, it's extraordinary.
But the fun of that and the beauty of that is also trying to build a world with enough clues and enough information where the writer can also trust the reader to put it all together. Because, you know, and I will say, readers are very sophisticated. And especially in some ways, too, now everyone has watched so much TV on top of all else. That the ways in which narratively, one used to have to kind of lay things out, like the, you know, the carriage wheels roll down the path to whatever, you can now cut to that. You know, you could like Jane Eyre, you know, on speed. It would be like, you know, pulled up to the house, you know, the carriage pulled up to the house. You don't have to like give the long preludes to things in the same way.
In fact, you can't. I remember I've been talking to, who was I speaking with? Someone, a friend of mine who writes for middle readers, is that what they're called?
Totally.
And she's just like, you can't kids won't read the books we read. You can't give someone Harriet the Spy. It's right. too slow. It's right. too slow right. for kids. Kind of like right. you try to watch an old movie and they're just like, when is it going to cut this frame? Right. You know, it's right. just a different, it's just people, and you're right, people can follow multiple threads. They can see the sort of proverbial MacGuffin that's mm-hmm. whatever, red herring right. that's been dropped somewhere, and they're waiting for these
yes.
clues.
Yes. Yeah.
So that is true.
Yeah.
You know, so I want to ask about writing The Mistress's Daughter, mm-hmm. writing a memoir in your 30s. Mm-hmm. And I would never, like, I sometimes put myself in my work, but
yeah.
I just don't know the courage it takes to do that and whether you felt better after having done it.
It's so funny. No, everyone always asks that. And the answer is absolutely not. No, everyone always thinks when you write a memoir, you're going to feel better afterwards. Absolutely not.
Oh, God.
I think that for me, part of it was the desire to capture the information and the experience of being found by my biological parents, you know, when I was in my 30s. And also the awareness that if I didn't capture that information and kind of put it in a container of some sort, it would change over time because we change over time and the rest of one's life and history unfolds. And so I wanted to be sure to kind of get that. And then in part two, I felt there were times I thought, God, I really don't want to finish this. You know, it's very hard and painful. But I also thought in multiple ways that I was bringing to it my skills as a writer that I had developed, you know, doing lots of other things. And that was a plus because I think finding language for what I would describe as primitive emotional experience
yes.
is very difficult. And I found it difficult, but I also felt that it would have relevance to other people who were struggling with that. And I think I feel good about that part of it. And I feel like I did a good job, but I would not describe the experience of writing memoir or autobiograph quickly as pleasant at all.
I think I did the yeah. weird lawyerly thing yeah. where you ask them a question you know the answer to, because you mm-hmm. also described it as a feeling of having vomited, which mm-hmm. is not a great feeling at all.
No.
Yeah, so but you have no choice, kind of, is the way that describes it.
I would say exactly. Unlike, yeah, it's not like it's, you know, I think people always think it's going to be cathartic. And it's also interesting because we live at a time when people, there is a lot of kind of navel gazing and a lot of like confessional, you know, I was a drunk and now I'm not a drunk and here's what happened. I've never been particularly drawn to that kind of writing. And I do think even now, like there's some other stuff I'm interested in writing about that is autobiographical. And I think for me, it's mostly about demystifying things. Mm-hmm. And like at some point I might write about having learning disabilities, being a terrible student, being somebody who nobody thought would have success of any kind. Because I think for others who have those struggles, that can be useful information. Like I'm always talking to my students about that, which is funny because I teach at Princeton and they are not, you know, particularly disabled students. Although sometimes I have some, but I want them to know that, you know, we also live in a moment where people look at somebody's, whether it's your social media or your outward self, and they go, that person is successful. And whatever the road is to that is not necessarily as simple as people think. And I want to acknowledge struggle. I think it's really important. And I think that it's not necessarily a bad thing either. Everyone's like, oh, you know, I should be ashamed if I'm struggling. I should be this if I'm struggling. I'm like, struggle is struggle. And everybody struggles at some point in some way. And by the way, boring be the person who never struggled. I mean, how weird would that be, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine what that would be like. I think that if you have any empathy, then you would see struggling all around you then. Right, and that would be right. like the boundary between your happiness and someone else's, I would hope, isn't that, you know, I hope it's more porous than all that.
Right,
But your mother, I should say, you have two mothers, but your birth mother.
I only have one mother.
Oh, You only
right?
have
I
one.
I really have the mother who raised me.
The mother who raised you. In your book, yes. But the woman who gave birth to you went to find you.
Yes.
And almost became childlike, needed to be parented in this way that, I mean, it was just overwhelming. I mean, I could say you can really relate to your situation. And yet at the same time, I think you did good by her. I think I'm also super curious about where things landed with your father. Are you the guy who impregnated her? I don't know how to say this because he really wasn't a father to you.
Yeah.
Your biological parents, these biological parents. But the person who I just absolutely adored in your book was your grandmother.
Yeah.
And obviously your love for her came through.
Yeah.
Do you think she was the most important parental figure in your life? Actually, I shouldn't say, again, I'm doing that American thing.
Yeah.
It seems like she contributed in a really meaningful way.
Yeah, absolutely. She contributed in a really meaningful way. I would say, you know, in some ways, and as a parent, I think I have a different experience. It's not too, I think she was somebody who the relationship was not complicated, right? The relationship, because if you have adoptive parents and biological parents and they have needs of their own, and my adoptive family had a child who passed away and there was a lot of grief in the family and so on, my relationship with my adoptive grandmother was much less complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And she was a very interesting, powerful woman in her own way. She was somebody who had been raised on a dairy farm in Massachusetts, and ultimately, sequentially, she came down to Washington, D.C., to work like during the First World War, you know, in the government, and then sequentially brought, you know, all of her 9 brothers and sisters and parents to Washington. So moved the family there and moved them really from a rural farming life into, you know, urban business and all that stuff. And, you know, later in life, she had an investment club. And she was one of the women who started the first bank in this country by women for women in the 1970s.
Has anyone written about her?
No. There were articles a little bit about the bank years ago.
Uh-huh.
And she ran a business, a wine importing business, you know, with my grandfather, with her husband. And she was really, like, in a way out there and really like an advocate for women's abilities to do things. And in that sense, she was powerful.
Did you say where she was born? Did you tell me that?
She was born in North Adams, Massachusetts.
Oh, right around me, near the hairpin turn.
Yes, absolutely.
I live in Northampton.
Okay, yeah, right. So they totally used to, her brothers used to sell gas and also water on the hairpin turn because I guess a lot of cars would overheat. And they were always, the Mohawk Trail, that was where they.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yep. And so she was born in the U.S. Were her parents, like, where does the family come from before that?
Her parents came from Latvia, and she was born in 1900 in the U.S.
Wow.
And she was also somebody who had eye problems and didn't know there were stars in the sky till she was 15 and got glasses.
That's incredible.
I know.
And your there was something that I had read about your biological father's ancestry that sounded kind of unbelievable.
Yes. Well, on the other side, and it's interesting because I think, you know, when I think about that part of things, I do think of myself as being of and from all of these people. And in that way, I think of myself as being both very American and very layered. So my biological father's family is interesting because his father was a Jewish man from New York who married a woman whose family had landed on the eastern shore of Maryland in the 1500s on one of the first ships that came from England. And we were, you know, property owners in Maryland so long ago that at one point the family owned the land that Capitol Hill is. So they owned really all of Capitol Hill.
Oh, my God.
And I would say sold it in like 1550 or something crazy like that.
Well, that was a mistake.
Exactly. Oops.
Jesus.
But it is interesting to think about, you know, how all of those experiences play out on people. And I think, you know, when I look at, we're talking a little bit about the big guy and what does that mean? I think when somebody's history goes back that far and they know those threads are there, there is a kind of entitlement and there is a kind mm-hmm. of big guy swagger and space occupying that when you see somebody just doing it, you think, where does that come from? And then you see other people who are immigrants or who may have come more recently who feel unentitled or not able to ask for or claim or, you know, get what they want and need. So all of that interests me, you know, always enormously.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to think, there's so many different sides to your family. Oh, but we don't need to do that. What are you, so you work in so many different genres, fiction, nonfiction, playwriting, even screenwriting.
Yep.
What do you do that for just, what kind of mindless fun do you do that's unrelated to reading and learning and writing?
Well, that's a good question. I would say I love art. I secretly collect a little tiny bit of art, but I love looking at pictures. I love, you know, I love traveling. I love looking at places, but I comfort myself by wherever I go, you know, a book tour or anything. The first place I go is a museum or a library because those are sort of my safe spaces and that's where I find myself. I love listening to music, you know, from all time periods and so on. I find that is a big piece of unlocking my brain. I've been recently writing operas. I've written two.
Oh, really?
More. Yep.
Is that through a connection with David? Because David's other friend wrote the libretto from, I have a friend who's a composer and Luna Pearl Wolf.
Yeah.
If you know her, she's a good friend and not David, one of David Handelman's friends wrote a libretto for one of her opera. She just wrote an opera about Madoff and also the Queen of Hawaii. Anyway, so what did you work on an opera?
I want to write an opera for her. I really am into it.
You would like her so much. I can absolutely connect you. I owe her a phone call, but yeah.
Do that. That would be fun. Yeah, I really, really enjoy that because what to me also, because opera has music and language and visual mm-hmm. and acting, and it really feels to me like you can do so many things in it and there's so many different elements and ways to tell a story. And so I'm very, very interested in that. I'm actually going to be teaching a class this spring, an experiments in opera class at Princeton with a composer. And that'll be fun.
What opera did you work on?
I did an opera for the Kennedy Center, a short opera for the 50th anniversary that opened there this spring. And then I did a full-length opera that had six composers for this company experiments in opera a couple years ago that turned out exponentially better than I ever would have thought and was really cool. And it's funny, my grandmother, the one we were speaking about, used to listen to the opera all the time. Mm. And she was the kind of person who liked to get her hair done on the weekends. She would get like, I don't know, what would say, like a blower.
Every Friday? My mother used to get her hair set. Set on Saturdays.
It was like they would get their hair set. Remember, they would have to sit under the dryer.
Those little dryers.
So I would usually on Saturdays, I would be driving around, I don't know, with my grandmother most of the day, and she'd be listening to the Metropolitan Opera broadcast in her Bonneville. Well, you know, and that was just part of my childhood and the opera quiz and all of that stuff. And that, to me, that's like the best stuff because that is the stuff that just sinks in the same way that my dad used to go to museums all the time. That was mm-hmm. what we did. You know, they weren't like, let's go, you know, play catch or do whatever. It was very, very sort of intellectual and kind of serious. And these inadvertent educations that have really, I would say, sustained me in many ways.
What are you thinking about doing or what have you started to do with your own child to carry some of those traditions forward while also recognizing that this is their own person?
It's difficult because it's not as easy as it used to be to make your child do something. I don't know how to say that more than that. Or maybe I'm not as good at it.
No, I think that describes.
Right? Right.
No comment.
Yeah.
No
so, comment. You know, yeah. one hopes that some of it rubs off. And I will say, a couple months ago, she was home from college and said something like, let's go to the Metropolitan Museum. And I was like, you know, okay, you know, absolutely. And then quickly, you know, renewed my membership that I'd let lapse because no one would do it. But I think, you know, one hopes a little bit. And she got a little bit into music. She was really not into, you know, sort of other than contemporary music when she was singing in a choir. And all of a sudden, it was interesting because she wrote her college essay about discovering her Jewishness by singing Christian music at school. And so that was
like Leonard Byrne, like what kind of music written
well,
by Jews or written,
you know, everything from, I guess, a lot of the choral music that was taught at her school, you know, had Christian roots. And then whenever there was a story that was, had any Jewish, whatever, the choral director would be like, and this story is for you to sing.
Oh gosh. I have to, that reminds me, I've got to tell you this. This is what family legend. So I love Christmas music, and I was in a singing group, and really, I think we maybe sang part of Handel's Messiah. I mean, I love this, but similarly, my older brother is 2 years older. When he was in his, it was a boys school and a girls school kind of together, and at the boys school, his guy in charge of the sort of choir wanted to. I guess my brother was complaining to him and the other Jewish kids that, you know, how come there are no songs for Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. So he said, well, why do we always sing that stupid Hanukkah, Hanukkah, come light the menorah, whatever, or dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. And they said, well, Mr. Bellinger, whatever, said, is there another song? And so my brother said, yes, there's a song we sing in our family. And the lyrics were, Ani rotzeach lechaleit lebeit ha-shamush. Do you know what that means in Hebrew?
No, what is the translation?
I have to go to the bathroom.
That's really
and so my brother put that to the tune of some Jewish, you know, some like
so
dreidel,
funny.
Dreidel, dreidel, what the heck?
Right.
And he had all the kids singing it until like this one kid, I don't know who it was, I'll have to ask my brother if he listens to this. We'll see if he's listening. Adam,
yeah.
you come tell me. But one of the kids ratted him out, like, why are we singing I Have to Go to the Bathroom? And
so
he
funny.
Got in so much trouble. Yeah, he was like that. It was great having an older brother like that.
What school was that?
So I'm from Michigan.
Yeah.
It's Cranbrook. It's now Cranbrook. I went to Kingswood, and it has that graduate art school.
Yes,
are you familiar
absolutely.
With it? Or?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Well, so my kid went to school not far from Northampton up in at Northfield Mount Hermon.
Yes, of course.
Which
of
is
course.
So much fun. Yeah, she had a really good time.
But was she there during COVID?
Part of it, yeah.
Oof. Yeah, I have a kid who just graduated from college, and I have one in high school now. And so that's all been an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Well, so we need to, I mean, this is like the beginning of a beautiful friendship, I think.
I think so.
I mean, although that movie doesn't really hold up in the way that one
Which
had hoped
movie?
It would. That's from Casablanca.
Oh, right.
The very end.
See?
Sorry, spoiler. Spoiler.
No, totally. Now that you rings a bell. Yes.
You know what's so funny though, but you know these when you watch these old movies about love, and when you're young, you're like, how could he leave Ingrid Bergman with the high key lighting, and she's so gorgeous?
Right.
And now I'm older, I'm like, yeah, that would have gotten old. But it's better just to have the guy friend and hang out.
That's really funny.
In the fog.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know. I've changed.
Totally. Yes.
I've changed. Anyways, is there something that I should have asked you about that I didn't?
I don't know.
Or you
don't
should have know. Asked me about or something?
I don't know. I'm not sure. There's so many things one could ask about.
Well, how do you know David, since he's been such an important feature in our friendship, our young friendship?
That is a good question. I want to say I feel like I knew David a tiny bit long, long, long ago, and then got to know him a little bit more through Writers Guild stuff and various
great
things. And then through his and Sid's love of theater, which they go to so much more deeply than I do.
And she's a playwright too,
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe I'll have to have Sid on next. I mean, anyone David knows, right? Just have the whole...
He knows a lot of people. He knows good people.
He does.
Yeah.
He does. Well,
I'm
it's
not that
been
good
such
of,
a pleasure.
I wish I was a better people collector. I'm a little introverted for people collecting, but I...
Oh, but just you only need to know a couple people collectors, and I can, you know, I'm one...
Collect
one,
people you for
know.
You, right?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
You name a topic, I'll tell you, I can connect you with somebody.
Fantastic. Well, look at that. And what can I do for you?
Well, would you be on my podcast? It's called Booked Up.
Yeah, I would love to. I've heard it's wonderful.
So we haven't, I hate to tell you, we haven't been taping. This is just the pre-interview, AM. So now we have to go do this all over again. I hope you remember everything we spoke about since you've, is that okay?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, great. Well, next time I'm in New York, I will tell David we have to get together.
That would be so much fun. I would love that.
Me too.
Absolutely.
Have a great rest.
I have to leave you with the Northampton thing. So speaking of playwrights, here's one last thing I'll tell you. So a million years ago, I want to say it was like maybe 93 or something when my book In a Country of Mothers was coming out. And I came up to Northampton to give a reading. And, you know, the bookstore would send like a young person to pick you up and drive you in circles to kill time. And I had just started thinking, I want to buy a house somewhere. And we're driving around. And I said, oh, my God, that's exactly the house I want to buy. It was a white house with a front porch and a swing and a red front door. And she goes, that's wild. That's where Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was.
Yes. I know which house it is. It's right on the Smith campus. Yep.
So I said to Edward Albee, you know, not that long after that, I said, Edward, the weirdest thing.
Shut the fuck up. You can just throw out that sentence. I said to Edward Albee.
Continue. I knew Edward because I had been a guest at his artist residency several times. And, you know, I'm adopted and Edward is adopted. And Edward was from Washington, D.C. So we used to talk about these things. And I said to Edward, this is the weirdest thing. But I was, you know, being driven around Northampton and I pointed to this house and I go, that's exactly the house I want. And he thought that was the funniest thing ever. And I have to say, it is so weird that in terms of sensibility, the one random house a person would point to in America is the house where Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was filmed. And that is so my sensibility and my heart, which is wild.
I just have to take this moment because if I had ever met Edward Albee, it would be like the first 30 seconds of my talking to another writer, not like right before we're about to wrap up. And secondly, I love him. I love the line from A Zoo Story where he says you have to go long distance to come back the right way correctly. I knew that was sort of my life's path, that I was off track. Also, I obviously love Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. What a dump. And I saw Three Tall Women when it came out. And it was incredible.
Did you see the newer iteration of it or the original?
The original when it came out. Why? Yeah, with what's her name? Who were the three women? I'm trying to remember, but it was the original cast because it must have been in the 90s when I was living in New York.
Absolutely. Yep. It's interesting because I remember seeing it then, and then they redid it a couple years ago, and it was so interesting to see the redo of it. It was fascinating.
Did you like the redo?
Yeah, I did. No? I actually did. Yeah.
God, I've got to get back into theater in New York. It's just been, you know, with kids.
Because I so have to go. I haven't been doing anything, and I feel like, you know, lame and out of it. Although I did see Leopoldstadt, which I recommend.
Okay. Well, we'll just make a list. I will only watch a musical if it's really good.
I don't really like a musical. I'm like, I don't come here to sing along. I come here to be traumatized.
And with that, thank you. I came here to be traumatized too. So that's good.
We're gonna come. All right. Bye.
That was such a great conversation. This literally was the first time I have ever seen or spoken to A.M. Holmes. I have read her work and some book reviews about her. And of course, my friend David Handelman, who we kept mentioning, has recommended her to me over the years. And so this was so wonderful. I'll keep you guys updated if we ever meet in person and go see some plays. Maybe I should even have her back in a little bit to talk about what we saw and what she's working on next. And be sure to tune in for the next Booked Up with Jen Taub and follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.